B. Got a sprain or an itch. Pain that's swelling a twitch. Call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky. Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. January 1st of each year, traditionally, is the date that New Year's resolutions are supposed to start. But there are other things that also often start on the first of the year, such as laws and government agency enactments. But before I get to these, I'd like to give you two facts. First, the number of Americans aged 65 and older is projected to more than double from 46 million today to over 98 million by 2060. And the 65 and older age group share of the total population will rise to nearly 24% from today's 15%.
Secondly, it is a fact that research has shown that 50% of older adults who live on their own and 75 to 85% of the elderly in care facilities suffer from chronic pain.
Yet even amid all the brouhaha concerning the rise of opioid use and addiction, pain among older adults is largely undertreated with serious health consequences such as depression, anxiety, decreased mobility, social isolation, poor sleep, and related health risks. So for the next couple of minutes, Carmen and I are just going to summarize what the new limits for high-dose opioid prescriptions, which were enacted on January 1st, 2019, for Medicare Part D users, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also called CMS, actually state, and afterwards, we'll talk about what the implications might actually be for those with chronic pain.
The new enactments state that for those patients who rely on Medicare paying for their pain medications, their prescriptions will be held to a standard of a total daily dose of 90 morphine milligrams equivalent, or MME.
This follows the CDC prescribing guidelines, which we've talked about on past shows, and these were recommendations put forth several years ago by the Center for Disease Control for Primary Care Physicians, released just last year.
For those who are unfamiliar with the term morphine medical equivalents, or MME for short, what the government is talking about is that there is a general ceiling of the total amount of opioid medication that can be prescribed daily to a patient with chronic pain.
The keys here are twofold. First, the MME is the total dose per day of all opioids, not just morphine. Secondly, there is a different MME for each medication. For example, 90 milligrams morphine is equivalent to 60 milligrams oxycodone, 30 milligrams oxymorphone, and somewhere around 20 milligrams of methadone. So, for example, a patient taking 20 milligrams oxycodone twice a day and 15 milligrams morphine twice a day has reached their 90 MME ceiling that was suggested by the CDC and now mandated by Medicare.
The Medicare announcement also sets limits for opioid-naive patients on seven-day prescriptions, but today we are talking specifically about patients who have long-term or chronic pain, meaning pain that has lasted for at least 3 months.
The announcement also identifies high-risk opioid users. These are defined as follows. First, those using high levels of opioids from multiple sources, and those who are using other medications, for example, benzodiazepines, that increase the risk for adverse effects from opioids. These are now called potentiator users.
With around 42.8 million people enrolled in Medicare Part D as of 2017, and a precedent for setting industry example, the agency hopes to address the opioid epidemic with this limit, aiming for an overall reduction in opioid overuse and overdose.
We are also not talking about persons with cancer or terminal illnesses. This will not affect patients in long-term care facilities or hospice. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, again, CMS, have already begun to implement these new safety rules on January 1st, just 5 days ago. It could make it harder for over 1 million Medicare beneficiaries to get prescriptions filled for higher doses of opioid pain medications. Now, the intention of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is to reduce the risk of opioid abuse and addiction. Again, remember that at this time, they only apply to patients enrolled in Medicare's Advantage and Part D prescription drug programs and exempt patients in palliative and hospice care or those being treated for active cancer-related pain.
But many patients and advocates fear that rules give too much power to insurers and pharmacists and could result in widespread confusion or patients being denied medications they have taken safely for years.
Many feel that the new CMS rules will be totally misinterpreted, misunderstood, and possibly weaponized to deny patients opioid pain medications. Any opioid prescription at or above 90 MME will trigger what is called an automatic safety edit, which will require pharmacists to talk with the prescribing doctor about the appropriateness of the dose.
If you're satisfied with the explanation or if a prior authorization was already granted, the pharmacist could override the safety edit and fill the prescription.
Right now, insurance companies can also impose their own hard edit for patients getting 200 milligrams morphine equivalent or more, which will require pharmacists to contact the insurer before filling a prescription. Insurers will also be given greater authority to identify patients at high risk of addiction and can even require they use only selected prescribers or pharmacies.
The bottom line for patients is that pharmacists and insurers, not doctors, could be the final arbiters of whether a prescription is appropriate and should be filled.
As a conscientious physician, I have no problem at all if a pharmacist wishes to call me to discuss a patient's prescriptions. The problem is that all too few pharmacists are willing to take the time to talk to the physician before denying the patient's prescription without the benefit of speaking with the physician prior to their refusal. If your Medicare drug plan decides your use of prescription opioids and benzodiazepines isn't safe, the plan could limit your coverage of these drugs. For example, under its DMP, your plan may require you to get these medications only from certain doctors or pharmacies to, quote, better coordinate your health care.
According to Bob Twillman, PhD and executive director of the Academy of Integrative Pain Management, the process that they decided on that is having pharmacists confer with prescribers is really a good idea in the abstract, but in practice, it's going to be very burdensome.
One consequence of the burden of the mandated phone conversations between pharmacists and prescribers could turn out to be such a time-consuming endeavor that many prescribers will just decide not to prescribe the dose that's necessary, but rather a low enough dose that those phone calls will not be triggered. The net effect in many cases could be disastrous and will, according to Twillman, be to encourage prescribers to drop their doses below that threshold, even if they feel that this is not the best medical treatment for their patient. Before I go on, I do have to tell you that even under this enactment, if a prescription is rejected by an insurer or pharmacist, the patient still has the option of paying for the medication in cash or could file an appeal.
CMS officials have confirmed that Medicare prescription drug coverage involvement is limited to payment for medications. If a patient receives a denial of coverage, the patient still has the right to pay out of pocket for that medication.
Andrea Anderson, executive director of the Alliance for the Treatment of Intractable Pain, also called ATIP, stated that a Medicare denial only applies to financial coverage. It has no authority to deny the prescription itself. And ATIP is encouraging patients denied medication to contact a little-known CMS agency called the Beneficiary and Family-Centered Care Quality Improvement Program, where they can file an appeal or make a complaint. For more information on this, you can go to their website address, bit.ly/ATIPNOW. That's bit.ly/ATIP now. According to Steve Arians, a retired pharmacist who runs the website pharmaciststeve.com, he states the following.
What all of these well-intentioned people are ignoring is the fact that the DEA considers a patient paying cash for a controlled substance when they have insurance a red flag.
Why, you may ask? Well, because the DEA apparently believes that this is what substance abusers or diverters do. They pay cash for their medications. So therefore, backwards reasoning states that anyone who pays cash for their controlled medications must be a substance abuser or drug dealer. That's like saying that since all ravens are black, then all blackbirds must be ravens. For logicians, this type of false reasoning actually has a name. It's called Hempel's paradox.
Arian says that he has not seen anything about the DEA looking the other way when a patient has insurance that will not pay and the patient pays cash.
Already, many patients who are treated with opioid medications for chronic pain can tell you their independent pharmacists have often told them that they will not accept cash from an insured patient for a Schedule II drug. If you can't eat meat, you must find an alternative protein source for your nutrition. If you can't or won't live in a house, then you have to find a substitute place to live, such as an apartment. And if you can't find relief for pain using one treatment, then you must find another in order to lead as comfortable a life as possible.
With many of the suggested treatments for pain such as physical therapy, massage therapy, acupuncture are too expensive or simply not covered by your insurance policy, then you have to find some other treatment modality that alleviates or lessens your pain as well as improves your ability to perform your normal daily activities.
Hope for the future drives us. Life's enjoyments drive us. When pain interferes with our lives on a daily basis with no hope of alleviating it in the future, life begins to wear on us. For some, this stress and depression is too great. You may suffer from chronic pain. In fact, 100 million people in the U.S. do. Or you may have a family member, friend, or even just an acquaintance with long-term pain and suffering. Before we go limiting one treatment, we need to have a replacement that patients can afford or take advantage of. Well, it's time for our mid-show break. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky with Carmen Lasky, and this is Hey Doc. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
A summer ago, the people of Argentina were able to find rare joy in the achievements of their beloved World Cup soccer team. On the other hand, the people of Spain found that World Cup eliminations spoiled the arrival of their new king.
The World Cup, along with other major sporting events like the Olympics, or even a single event such as LeBron James returning home, interests many people. But why do so many of us across the world enjoy watching sports, even when they themselves may not ever have had even a participation in any of them? In other words, for example, why are so many people die-hard Jaguar fans, Miami Hurricane fans, or Atlanta Brave fans, just to name a few?
Many psychologists believe that there are actually 8 different motivations. One reason that people seem to like watching sports is because they get self-esteem benefits from it.
Another reason may simply be that they have money on it. People also actually like sports because their boyfriend or girlfriend or family member likes sports as well. For many people, sports are enjoyed because they're just exciting. People may also like sports because they're aesthetically pleasing. Sports may also be a venue for emotional expression.
And many people like sports because they need an escape from real-world troubles. And finally, people may like sports because they provide a sense of belonging, a connection to a wider world.
In other words, there's no single answer to why people watch sports, because the answer doesn't lie in the game. It lies inside the individual.
In 2011, for example, a book titled This Is Your Brain on Sports was published.
This being a medical show, we wanted to find some physiological reasons for this liking of sports by non-participants. Now, I can remember when I was young, I was following my mother in one of the larger clothing stores in New York while she shopped for clothing, maybe Macy's. Being that we were in the women's section, I was only paying attention to the radio that was heard throughout the store. It happened to be the third game of the 1964 World Series on Saturday, October 10th, in Yankee Stadium, with the New York Yankees and the St. Louis Cardinals. As a matter of fact, Mickey Mantle was at bat, having erred early in the game, allowing the tying run to come in. End of the ninth inning. It's Mantle against a well-known knuckleball pitcher. First pitch, and Mantle swings and hits the ball into the third deck of Yankee Stadium. I remember that without thinking, I screamed, I jumped up and down, just as many others in the store did at the same moment, gleefully, that we won that game. I was excited, exuberant, joyful, maybe just plain happy. But why? During the first few seconds while the pitcher still holds the ball, you as the viewer are in the brain of the pitcher. Then for the 400 milliseconds or so that the ball leaves the pitcher's hand hurtling towards home plate, your brain switches to the batter's brain and then mentally follows the ball as it connects to the batter's bat and then is driven to the opposite side of the stadium. In this case, the third-tier seats in Yankee Stadium. Then, since I was listening to it on the radio, my brain then listens for the words that Mel Allen, the Yankees play-by-play announcer, said, and that was, "It's a home run."
Whatever your fan loyalties, your brain couldn't help playing both sides and all roles. What your eyes see or your ears hear, your brain plays as best it can, which is, of course, as variable as our actual playing and living.
The evidence that the spectating brain is also a playing brain has been mounting ever since the early 1990s, when a group of neurophysiologists at the University of Parma in Italy implanted electrodes in the brain of a macaque monkey to find out exactly which neurons fired when the monkey grasped a peanut and brought it to its mouth.
The electrodes were placed in the monkey's premotor cortex, which is the region known to initiate signals that direct muscle movement in both macaque and humans. The Parma team succeeded in their original brain mapping goal, but it was an accidental discovery that made Parma a world-renowned source of cutting-edge neuroscience.
One researcher had a eureka moment in the Parma lab. He heard a monitor buzz, indicating that the monkey's peanut-grasping neurons were firing. But the monkey had no peanut. Instead, the monkey's same motor neurons that fire when the monkey eats the peanut also firing when he watched someone else perform that same action. Neurons in a macaque or human brain that are specialized to plan, select, and initiate our muscle movements should not fire to somebody else's muscle movements. But since they appeared to be firing, the researchers wondered what the difference was from our brain's point of view between doing and seeing, between playing the game and watching the game, and most fundamentally, between oneself and someone else's.
The answer, according to subsequent research on both monkeys and humans, is that in the healthy premotor cortex, the difference is about 80%. In other words, about one-fifth of the neurons that fire in the premotor cortex when we perform an action, say kicking a ball, also fire at the sight of somebody else performing that action. A smaller percentage fire even when we only hear a sound associated with an action, say the crack of a bat.
Let's go a bit more into depth on this subject. Researchers then took professional basketball players, sports writers, and avid viewers and used them as text subjects, watching players take free throw shots. Remember that when we see a familiar action, our mirror neurons activate, and their firing lasts exactly as long as the observed action. This allows us to instantaneously understand the action, its goal, and even the emotions associated with it, without ever having to do any inferential thinking about it. If we're watching strenuous action, mirror neurons even provoke a small but still measurable uptick in our heart and respiration rate.
In the first part of the experiment, the researchers had all three groups watch film clips of players attempting free throws. The clips were stopped at 10 mid-action intervals, and everybody was asked to predict the likely success of the free throws.
Not surprisingly, the players made more accurate predictions at every time interval, but their greatest advantage over both expert watchers and inexperienced students was at the earliest intervals, before the balls had even left the players' hands, when there were no trajectories to watch. So the question here is, why? Why were they so much better at predicting the outcome so early in the action compared with the sports writers and the viewers? This indicated that athletes were better than the others at understanding cues from the filmed players' bodies.
There was still more to learn from this experiment. The researchers also wanted to know how much their motor systems, primed by their mirror neurons, contributed to reading those cues. So they set up a second experiment using a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS.
This technique yields the exact timing of neuronal firing, so the researchers could monitor the patterns of motor system activity in all three groups as they watched the free throw video clips. Everyone's motor system perked up watching the action, but the students showed a generalized perk up, while both players and expert watchers showed activity on the specific motor areas involved in shot taking.
What separated the players from the expert watchers So it was greater excitation of the hand muscles controlling the ball, especially the muscle controlling the angle of pinky finger. And the instant the ball left the shooter's hand.
They were not necessarily visible movements of the pinky, but a measurable increase in what's called motor evoked potentials, which signal preparation for intended action. And amazingly, the most unpredictable result was that this activation was greatest when players watched the launch of a ball that was going to miss the basket. Maybe the brains of the spectating players were not just simulating the shot taking. Maybe they were trying to score, and so perhaps we're just not good at it. What this all suggested to the researchers is that the purpose of the mirror neuron system is to get you more attuned to the goal of the action rather than the action itself. In sports fan terms, this means if you're watching someone take a free throw and you've never played basketball, you're strictly congruent mirror neurons will not fire, but the broadly congruent ones that remember tossing a crumpled piece of paper into a wastebasket will.
Now, for a viewer who had a lot of previous experience playing a game, take for example football. Reading about football, for instance, has motor resonance because they can call you upon the parts of the brain they use playing to simulate the action in their heads. And that often makes it what they are reading easier to follow and makes them like that information better.
Our brain reuses motor experience we learn doing things to comprehend what we are watching or reading about. All of our experiences of doing in the world contribute to our comprehension of the world. It turns out that we reuse areas of the brain that control our fingers when we count in our head, because at one point we learn to count on our fingers, and those same areas of the brain come alive again. So every motor skill we master makes us smarter, and in a sense that the better you can do it, the better you can perceive it. So, is there an evolutionary purpose to the mirror neuron system?
It certainly is not to make better sports spectators, but it has more likely been designed to advance the species by helping us develop cognitive skills, including but not limited to predicting the success of free throws.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.